Kia ora ana, you're listening to Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. Ko Koroi Hawkins toku ingoa. Coming up,
we have the opportunity and the privilege to raise a flag without being punished for it. I see it as a responsibility to be part of that.
West Papuans mark 60 years of fighting for self-determination.
We said all of the protocols to come to Fiji were still worth it given what they had to look forward to.
Hundreds of tourists have started arriving in Fiji with tens of thousands more expected. And
we need that money to spend more on health and not on infrastructure. I think that is the right decision.
We dissect Papua New Guinea's biggest ever budget. Pro-independence advocates say the human rights situation in West Papua continues to worsen because of deliberate ignorance by its Pacific neighbours and the international community. A collation of Pacific NGOs organised solidarity flag-raising events across the region today to commemorate 60 years since the banned Morning Star flag was raised in West Papua. The conflict-riddled, resource-rich territories on the western end of the island of New Guinea. It was controversially annexed by Indonesia through the UN-approved Act of Free Choice of 1969. Despite the mass exploitation of West Papuan gold, silver, copper and timber, it is among the least developed provinces of Indonesia and its indigenous population has suffered from decades of conflict. Ralph Reginvanu, Vanuatu opposition leader and the secretary of the Melanesian Indigenous Land Defence Alliance, says everyone knows what is going on in West Papua and everyone is being quiet on the issue.
What happened 60 years ago was a great betrayal of everything the international world order stands for, a great betrayal by the United Nations and the major countries, the members of the Security Council, of a people's right to self-determination.
Mr. Reginvanu says the injustice continues to be perpetuated and increased and expanded and has become intergenerational.
So we have generations of West Papuans who, because of their right to self-determination was denied 60 years ago, have continued to suffer. And if you put aside the human population, the resources are just being raped.
The Flag Day events kicked off at the Pacific Conference of Churches in Suva, where over 50 people gathered to commemorate the occasion. RNZ Pacific regional reporter Kelvin Anthony spoke to Reverend James Bhagwan, General Secretary of the Pacific Conference of Churches, about the West Papua Flag Day.
Obviously, today is a day of prayer and reflection, particularly because that's the only thing they can do, given the oppression by Indonesia.
You listed a set of asks from church leaders in West Papua. What are they asking for?
First and foremost on their call, of course, was the end to the systemic racism that has manifested itself socially, politically and economically. That's at the heart of much of these things, and we've seen that over the last few years. They firmly rejected the second so-called special autonomy law that has been promulgated on the basis of the failure of the first special autonomy law that ran for 20 years. The other is, of course, the call for the UN human rights team to come into Papua and witness. And this is something that is not only from the churches, not only from the ULMW plea, but is a call from the Pacific Islands Forum leaders. And, you know, we continue to call on the Indonesian government to do that. You know, the other is, of course, the dialogue to be held with the ULMWP. The ULMWP is the recognized political body for the people of West Papua, not just by the people, but by the member churches of PCC as well. And so in that token, we continue to affirm and call for these things to happen, and they need to happen right away.
So 60 years since the Morning Star flag was raised in West Papua, how important is today?
Today is a reminder of how long justice takes. A sad reminder that in this world, when we talk about democracy so freely, we talk about rights so freely in many parts of the world, that there's yet still people who are crying for that. The failure of so many international organizations, the international community has failed, the UN has failed. Of course, there's a lot of wealth in Indonesia, in the land, but it's a reminder that, you know, that justice is something that needs to be sustained, and the fight for justice is something that is intergenerational in many cases.
Now, the churches appear to be doing their part for the West Papuans, as well as the NGOs and the activists in the region. But are Pacific leaders doing enough?
At this year's UN General Assembly, we heard Vanuatu speak out very strongly on this issue at the General Assembly. We heard the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, you know, affirm the leaders' decisions at the 2019 Pacific Island Leaders Forum. And I think this is now very important for Fiji as the current chair of the Pacific Island Forum. They need to act on that. We understand that some countries, because of the influence of Indonesia and for their own reasons, but that doesn't mean they do not address the human rights abuse. We talk about neighbors and Vuvale and all those things in our region. And it's important that when we talk about loving our neighbors and loving our family, that we practice these things. And so we need stronger response on the ground from Australia and other members of the Pacific Islands Forum.
Meanwhile, an online arts exhibition is also being launched to commemorate 60 years of resistance by West Papuans. Joey Tao is a campaigner at the Pacific Network on Globalization. He says the exhibition will celebrate the importance of the arts for activism and soft diplomacy in West Papua's struggle for independence.
It celebrates those that have gone before, many of the West Papuan activists in this fight for freedom and justice, and those that are at the forefront. It features a wide range of submissions from art pieces, podcasts, vlogs, creative writing, poetry, and we have some of the likes of Joy Yanamoto from Hawaii, an established artist. We have some of the young solo artists from the Pacific, but we also have some commentators like Ralph Regan-Vanu, leaders of West Papua, the ULMWP.
In New Zealand, a lecturer in Pacific Studies at Victoria University, Dr. Emalani Case, says it's important to raise the flag in solidarity with West Papuans.
And in the ongoing effort to have independence and self-determination. So yeah, it's a big day. And I think for us, living here in Aotearoa, who have the opportunity and the privilege to raise a flag without being punished for it, I see it as a responsibility to be part of that.
Hundreds of tourists have arrived in Fiji, with tens of thousands more expected this month as the popular Pacific tourism hub reopens to international visitors for the first time in 2 years. Australia and the United States are the two lucky countries with first dibs, and flights from Sydney, Melbourne and LAX were welcomed to the Nandi International Airport on Wednesday. Our correspondent in Fiji, Lide Muvono, is in Nandi. Pula Lide, so a big day for Fiji. What was the atmosphere like at the airport?
It was a mix of emotions, I think, we observed here in Nandi, with, you know, the people working in the tourism industry just seemingly very happy and excited to be back at work and to be welcoming people off of an aircraft, something that they did every day for, you know, most of our modern history. But there was a tinge of emotion today, as it looked as if there were still some things that needed to be taken care of. People were still kind of learning the ropes again in how to be welcoming hundreds of people back home. But otherwise, the once well-oiled machine seems to be back on its feet this morning now, Karoi.
How much effort has gone into preparing for this?
The officials have worked together over a period of 4 months to bring back to its full capacity the infrastructure on which Fiji's tourism industry rides on. So, for example, Fiji Airport CEO Yusei Tundreo spoke about the privilege of not having to let go any of their staff who run Fiji's main gateway. But he did say that over the past few months, staff have had to work with very little hours, and now we're excited to be able to get their income back and to provide the services to welcome the Australians back to Fiji.
I acknowledge them today for all the hard work that has been put in place to ensure that we meet our first arrival. It's a happy day for us. I am going to say Pula, and we're going to share this Pula's life.
But it's also now about training hotel staff to be able to provide next to medical services. And that's been a lot of where the investment has gone into, is now a lot of the larger hotels are able to provide testing facilities, or at least swabbing services, for their
tourists who, of course, will require a COVID-free status when they do return.
I can just imagine the beautiful welcome these visitors will be arriving, the music and all of the bulas and smiles. Have you managed to speak to any of the visitors?
Oh, yes. People are very excited. There is a festive atmosphere out here at the airport. Well, it started, of course, with the arrival of the aircraft and the water salute that the airport fire authority gave their aircraft, and everything from the warriors that they had to greet every single passenger that got off of their aircraft, the VIP welcome that the ministers of government as well as the heads of all of the tourism stakeholders paid, which is quite unusual. And there's, of course, lots of fanfare, traditional ceremonies of welcome. There are dancers. There is a military brass band, the biggest in the Republic of Fiji military forces, lots of free gifts and gift bags to people. I think the big bula that is being shown today is quite unusual in many ways. Brent Hill, CEO of Tourism Fiji, said that partnership between the Australian and Fijian government that has facilitated the upgrading of Western public health medical services means that Fiji is now more ready than ever before, at least they think so, to be able to take care of another outbreak if one does actually occur.
It's a very long-awaited day. It's 615 days and a lot of preparation, a lot of work. Certainly from our perspective at Tourism Fiji, we would like to salute the tourism industry. This day is very much for them as a celebration of that Duavata spirit that everybody has, that has worked together to make today happen.
The Minister for Economy said that despite the very recent and real threats of the new variant, which is now in the community in Australia, Fijian health authorities working with the rest of the government has positioned services to be able to make sure that if there are positive cases that arises out of this particular entry of tourists, that the Fijian infrastructure is able to support that.
The rest of the world is also opening up. We have to ensure that we are in the ball game. Being in the ball game means that we need to continue to be a health, safe place. People feel confident to come to Fiji, knowing that we follow all the various protocols, knowing that we have a very high rate of vaccination. We also need to be price sensitive.
And you talked with a family from Sydney?
Lots of families that came off of this aircraft. It was surprising to see quite a lot of children, quite a lot of elderly, a very good mix of people coming off the aircraft. And a family that I spoke to, Gary, Laurie and his family from Sydney, of course, spoke about the need to take a break from, you know, COVID-stricken Australia, as every country around the world has been. And he said all of the protocols, the extra requirements that are now made off of tourists who come to Fiji were still worth it given what they had to look forward to. And as you know, Fiji tourism authorities as well as the businesses here haven't been encouraged to offer very, very cheap packages to people that will take the risk to come to Fiji.
The Papua New Guinea government has introduced the country's biggest ever budget at just over $6 billion. Revenue is estimated to climb to $4.5 billion, leaving a deficit of $1.6 billion, which the government says is 5.4% of GDP. Don Wiseman spoke about the budget with Stephen Howes, a professor of economics at the Australian National University.
Overall, on the expenditure side, it is a rather restrained budget. There is a moderate increase in spending budgeted for 2022, which is an election year. Elections are rather expensive in PNG, and so that itself is an additional expense. And you know, you wouldn't expect the government to actually cut expenditure in election year. But after the budget year 2022, if we look at the forward estimates, we only see increases in expenditure in line with inflation.
And a significant amount of money going into health, as you'd expect, I guess, following all the problems with COVID-19, is it enough money?
It's certainly a large increase and it's very, very welcome. And I saw in the budget documents there's actually a big increase in funding for the church health services. And, you know, the church provides a lot of the health services in the remote and rural areas. Whether it's enough, I think know, it's never going to be enough. This is a long process. And the other, you know, key point to make is that the problems in the health sector are not only about lack of funding. You know, it's there are worker shortages. You know, we know there are massive problems with drugs, both with actually getting drugs at work and then getting them out to the centres. So money itself is not going to solve the problems of the health sector, but the significant increase you see in this budget directed at health is certainly very welcome.
And a significant amount of money as well going into education.
That's right. The government seems to have gone back to free education, which PNG's had several times, and most recently through O'Neill. The Marape government seemed to move away, well, did move away from that when it first came, when Marape first became Prime Minister, but now seems to have gone back towards free education. And again, I think that's something we should welcome. You know, there's no safety net in PNG. So one way government can support those who are poorer, those who are in rural areas, is by not charging them for sending their kids to school. That's going to get more kids into school, and it's going to make it easier for those rural households.
So what would you say are the most significant elements in this budget?
Well, I'd say two things. I mean, I think the most controversial and the one that's been talked about the most are these levies on the PNG's biggest bank, the Bank of the South Pacific, and PNG's biggest mobile phone service provider, Digicel. I mean, these two almost have a monopoly on their respective markets, and the government's taken the radical step in this budget of having a tax specifically directed at those two companies. I mean, I think you can argue the case both ways. I think it came as a surprise to a lot of people, and it certainly generated a lot of opposition, both from the companies and their shareholders, which include the big superannuation funds. So the trade unions have got involved in this as well. And from what I understand, the Prime Minister said yesterday, in fact, it looks like these levies have been deferred until the second half of the year, which is after the elections. So it does look like the government is at least somewhat walking away from this these two controversial levies. They are a small part of the overall increase in revenue, and that's what I'd say is the second striking part. I mean, this budget does project some very significant increases in revenue, both in the budget year and then going out through the forward estimates.
Is it pie in the sky, or is it going to happen?
Well, I think it's something the government has to do. PNG was already running large deficits before COVID, and not surprisingly, COVID has led to a higher deficit. And that's not something that can be sustained. So the overall direction in which this budget wants to take PNG, I think, is the right one, which is, you know, overall expenditure restraint. Yes, increases in priority areas like health, but overall expenditure restraint, and then increases in revenue so that you can bring down the deficit. I mean, the question is, are they going to be able to do it? And apart from those levies, there aren't any significant tax increases in the budget. So the increases in revenue are partly on the back of better commodity prices, and so more money from resource projects. I think everyone would welcome that. But then substantially on the back of improved tax administration.
I think
that's the question. Will this government actually be able to deliver improved tax collection and get that tax to GDP ratio up again?
And a significant amount of money going into infrastructure development in terms of this massive road that the government's promising.
That's right. I think that's been a feature of the last few governments, spending on infrastructure. And, you know, there's no doubt PNG needs that infrastructure investment. Again, the question is whether it's actually able to implement it in an effective way. I mean, I think one striking thing on the expenditure front that hasn't got a lot of attention is that they've actually reduced the funding going to members of parliament. You know, members of parliament used to get 10 million kina to spend in their electorate, and it looks like that's been reduced to 8 million kina. So I think that's a significant decision, again, in an election year. And the rationale for that is we need that money to spend more on health and on infrastructure, and I think that is the right decision.
That's Pacific Waves for today. Remember, you can download us free to your device from Spotify, iHeart or Apple Podcasts. If you're using Apple, please leave us a rating so others can also find us. Aere rā.